Chewbacca Hutchings joins us here on WVTF. It's last quarter. I'm Josh Jackson. Is your birth name Chewbacca?
Yeah.
Chewbacca being, you know, one of the pharaohs.
I think my parents weren't keen to just impress a lot of historical knowledge on me when I was young. My dad is a Rastafari, and he's very involved in the Rastafari community, so he knows a lot about Egyptology and Kemet and what the meaning of the name was. And the thing that they did try to instill in me is that the name was powerful, so they let me know who King Chewbacca was. He was the last Nubian ruler to rule over Upper and Lower Egypt before the Arab conquest. And I guess gave me a sense of pride in what your name is and the weight which it carries. People always make the obvious analogy to the Star Wars character. And that's the thing I've had all my life. You know, if someone says, "What's your name?" You say, "I'm Chewbacca." And they say, "Oh, like Chewbacca." And if you know the true, you like the weight of the name and where it comes from, what it means God of creation, you kind of feel like they're people that are making light of something that is important. And I think it's a good lesson, especially in these times, that you will get people that joke and kind of see the simplicity in issues that actually are quite big, but maybe they don't have the full context.
When did you feel that you had a real joy of learning the clarinet, which I understand is your first instrument?
I think from the time I started it.
Really?
No one told me to play. The teacher came around in lunchtime, and she said, "Who wants to be in the recorder group?" I put up my hand because I was bored. And then the recorder group automatically got picked instruments, and the music teacher said, "Hey, here's a clarinet, you're playing it." So I was like, "Okay, cool." I wanted to play the saxophone, but they had more clarinets than saxophones, so they gave me one of them. And I just liked, I'm an only child, and I think I liked that feeling of sitting in a room working on something by yourself. And then you can chisel at it and chisel at it, and you come up with a creation.
So as an only child, you sort of have an understanding between the difference of loneliness and being alone.
Yeah, there's a definite difference. And I think those differences interweave. They're not binary. But I guess as an only child, you learn to be comfortable with both, you know. And maybe the periods of transition are the things that actually cause you the most turbulence. I'm fine if I'm alone. I'm fine just operating by myself. And I'm fine being lonely because I understand what loneliness is. It's not like either one of those are preferable. I do like being around people. But I think as an only child, you get plunged into actually being alone. There's no choice some of the times. So you learn what those different atmospheres are. And I guess it's good in life because you can not be anxious about it when it hits you at some point.
When did you pick up the saxophone?
When I was about 16, when I came to England, I got an alto sax. Just because I always wanted a saxophone, there was a hire purchase program, took saxophone out and would just jam on it, try to play jazz. One of the first people I met was Soweto Kinch, and I met him backstage at a Courtney Pine concert. He's just like a rough-looking dude in a leather jacket, and he said, "I do a jam session every week at this like little wine bar." And I had my new saxophone. And I'd been listening to, starting to listen to jazz. So I was like, cool, I go to the jam session. Like, maybe eight people in the room. And he played there every Sunday, every single Sunday. So for 2 years, I just went to this jam session. It's actually quite inspiring how much he took in a young player who was really crap. You know, someone who's just coming with the saxophone and going, "Hey, I'm interested in this jazz thing. But my sound is terrible. I've got no jazz knowledge. I've just got pure enthusiasm." And he'd invite me to come every week, and then he'd play a set and he'd invite me up. He'd take me to his house and we'd listen to records together. He'd lend me some records and I'd copy them. And it was a real just kind of hanging out thing. I remember at one point we were practicing together and we'd just go for 2-5-1 phrases, just like jazz language, slowly and just play it in unison. And I kind of said, "Oh, here's something I learned this week." And he played it. And then he's like, "Oh, great, you know, I've learned something from you." And it felt good to, for someone I looked up to at that stage, to say, you have information that is valuable. It's not just, I'm telling you stuff and you go away and, you know, receive everything I've got to give you.
Do you find, as your career progresses, Shabaka Hutchings, that you are attempting to find that feeling that you just described when it was very exciting learning early on in the process?
Yeah, I feel like the journey of being a musician is starting with pure enthusiasm and excitement, then learning how it all works and getting really daunted. Then maybe surpassing that feeling of being daunted and understanding what it is and understanding how you do it, then maybe achieving the thing that you set out to achieve, but not being excited at the music, just being excited of being able to achieve, say, mastery of the saxophone, knowledge of the jazz language. And then I think there's another stage that we're all kind of trying to go towards, which is then just being excited again. It's not about how much stuff you've learned. It's not about how good you are on your particular instrument. It's just about sharing an experience with the other musicians on stage, because you are all about the experience, and that experience transmits joy to yourself and to the audience. Whenever I see artists that I respect, that's the first thing that hits me. Like seeing Wayne Shorter, I've seen him maybe 5 times coming to England, and every time I see him, it's like he's on stage having a good time, you know. And that good time isn't just I'm having a good time, I wave my hands in the air with a beer. That good time is that we're feeling the intensity of what it is to be human.
Shabaka Hutchings joins us here on Last Quarter. I'm Josh Jackson. This is WVTF. Can you tell me what's the first recording of a saxophonist that you heard that, you know, you said, I want to do it like that, or at least try to get there?
I think the first one that I really thought I want that was a recording by Myron Walden.
Really?
Like a Flower Seeking the Sun.
Okay.
And I'd heard lots of jazz, and that's something that Soweto was really into, that album as well. And he passed it on to me, and I was like, whoa. So then I checked out the album he did before, the Hypnosis album. And there's something about Myron Walden's playing, especially in that period of time. It's like he gets that cry, like when he'll build and develop the solos, but then it's like he's building and developing to break through into a certain like emotional zone. And that's what I'm really interested in. When he's in that zone and it's like peak intensity, he doesn't let it go in this really intense space. And that's the first time I kind of thought, I want to be in that space. There's a tune on Like a Flower Seeking the Sun called Pulse. and it's a really slow, like brooding tune. And there's a point, maybe like three quarters of the way through the tune, when it completely explodes. And I remember I used to like be walking to the bus stop and just playing like the minute of this tune that it's like in the full intensity, repeating it, playing that. And it wasn't really about how we got there. It's just like, this is a space that I want to have and retain for as long as possible when I can do it.
Pulse, saxophonist Myron Walden, one of the recordings that influenced our guest today, Shabaka Hutchings. You have sort of a panoply of different projects musically. Let's talk about one of them, Sons of Kemet.
Okay.
What an interesting combination. This must be a saxophonist's dream, honestly, because you get two drummers. Yeah. I mean, come on, man.
I didn't really think of it when we started. It was literally a case of there was a small bar, Charlie Wright's, and they do gigs every Thursday. And they said, do you want to do a gig? And I was like, yeah. They said, put together a band. And I said, okay. And I just wanted to see what would happen if these four musicians play together. Obviously, I'll organize the music. So we've got some kind of common ground to start from. But the music was meant to be, I guess, non-complex enough for us to actually have our engagement as four human beings be the kind of focal point, as opposed to just the achieving of mastery of the music itself.
Was there some type of antecedent in the sound before you created this group? Like, were you thinking, I want to have like some kind of elements of a marching band, or what was going on behind the creation of what you wanted to write music for?
Yeah. So before Sons of Kemet, I had maybe 2 or 3 years of mainly doing free improvised music. I was invited to play in the London Improvisers Orchestra, say 3 years before Sons of Kemet. So I went along to that and started, at the same time I was getting into free improv records. So like starting from the States, the people like Albert Eiler, to Art Ensemble of Chicago, some of the AACM guys, Roscoe Mitchell. Then I was starting to explore some of the European free improvisers, so Evan Parker, Peter Brotsman, people like Masker Stapson. And I was playing in a lot of those settings, and that was where my main kind of artistic endeavors lied. So my headspace, coming back to Sons of Kemet, was from a place where I was doing a lot of free improvised gigs and really enjoying it, but having to negotiate a position of this music not containing an element of myself, which is a boy that grew up in the Caribbean who really enjoys Caribbean music. And it's not that I wanted to force Caribbean music onto my musical personality, but I thought that it could be portrayed in a more overt way in how I'm seen as an artist, or how I see myself as an artist. So I thought, I want a band that is Caribbean at base. And it's not that, you know, you don't hear Sons of Kemet and think, oh, that's a Caribbean band. But I wanted to start from that point of saying, as a free improviser, I want a band that I can write music with integrity, but it still contains elements of Caribbean diasporic music and the music that it comes from and the music that it's also projected off onto, where all of that is encapsulated in the music. Thank you.
Sit there and kind of consider the lineage, you know, as I hear you describe people like Albert Eiler and the Art Ensemble of Chicago, when you consider them, even as they are doing free improvisation, there's a lot of what they're doing in terms of counterpoint that's very closely related to the earliest forms of jazz in New Orleans. Mm. And then if you want to go back another step, you consider early New Orleans jazz and having its Caribbean influence.
Yeah.
So in some ways, you've sort of drawn a circle.
Yeah, and you kind of get back to the fact that what it is people of African descent being creative, you know, and they might be creative in a circumstance where that creativity merges with other cultures, such as what happened in New Orleans, a kind of fluid the act of, I guess, osmosis within culture is fluid. So it's like there in New Orleans, they're in a situation where you have creative people of African descent in a situation where they are other influences because they are in America. In the Caribbean, they don't have that initial exposure to the other. You know, I find it interesting seeing what the similarities in terms of rhythmic information, like rhythmic phrases. And also, I guess, patterns of speech, if you consider music to be some type of language, not in an academic way, kind of going, you know, this phrase starts here and ends here, but kind of seeing it in a looser, broad, like when I hear Charlie Parker go, and then you hear maybe a Calypsonian sing a line that goes, for me, it's like if you take away the fact that Charlie Parker is trying to operate within a harmonic prism and the Calypsonian is trying to operate within a more dance floor context, and you see them as musicians trying to give a rhythmic language to an audience by any means necessary, whatever the audience needs to be able to take on that rhythmic language within the context or the situation that they're in. For me, then the two people, the Calypsonian and the bebop musician, they come together because it's more about the accents and the rhythmic ideas on and what that triggers in our heads and our bodies when we receive that rhythmic information, of which the accents are an integral part.
And as an audience member who may or may not have, you know, musical theory or knowledge, they may not necessarily know that, but it's implied by the way they feel when they hear something.
Exactly. You know, it's like someone plays a line that goes, it's, you know, it's, there's nothing there. You can process it and you can go, okay, I heard what you just played. But if you go, then all of a sudden, like my body just changed when I was just singing.
Sure.
That. The audience's body, there's something in there that makes you go, hey, that sits you up. What I'm interested in is the power of music, the power of rhythmic information to make people sit up, especially in the context of today where it feels like a lot of people are considering themselves as being woken out of a sleep, whether that be in relation to how they see the economy or their propensity for taking on injustice without saying anything, or just what they can envision as an alternative future. And I feel like having an instrument that can get people to wake up on a molecular level, just kind of snap out themselves and move, and their brain is activated, you know, that can be a help.
As if they've just been fully immersed in a dunk tank.
Exactly.
You know, which I guess would make you awake.
Exactly, yeah.
You know. Shebaka Hutchings joins us here on Last Quarter. I'm Josh Jackson. We go from the Sons of Kemet which, you know, the word Kemet itself, you know, sort of has an origination in the deltaic soil of the Nile, as opposed to the Sahara and sort of the red desert. And so you think of things organic. Is there something organic about the comet is coming when you're working with electronic music?
Yeah, I mean, it's organic in, I guess, the truest way, in that we weren't supposed to be a band. The two other members of the Comets Coming are a band in their own right called Soccer 96.
Okay.
And I was a massive fan of this band. I loved them. Whenever they play and I was free, I'd just go and see them. After a couple of times, I just thought, why do I not have my saxophone here? I need to play these guys. So I started taking my saxophone to their gigs and just saying, hey, can I play on one tune? They were like, yeah, cool. So I'd play and it would always be really good vibes and everyone would really enjoy what's happening. We'd been saying for about a year, we need to get into a studio and just have a jam, record it. And nothing ever happened. And, you know, eventually we got into that studio and just left the tape rolling for 4 days. And just as soon as we started to play, what you hear on the album came out. So what's on the album is us cutting together the best bits out of really long jams. But we were jamming kind of like fully formed tunes. So a song like Neon Baby, which is on our first EP, which is called Prophecy. That, what you hear on the album, is the first take of us recording it on the first day. And we're just improvising, but we just improvised the tune. Started, and that's we record, we cut up the material, and then we started to do gigs. So then we started learning the stuff that we'd improvised on the spot, and using it as material to just develop a set. And for the next couple of years, playing like warehouse parties and just kind of small for people that we liked in that community around East London. And I really like that. I like the fact of the studio album not being anything like the live performance. Like, the studio album is just a thing. It's just what you work on.
Do you want your audience to have the same experience as with other of your ensembles when you're playing that music? I mean, do you want them to have this kind of thing that you talk about in terms of awareness or being awake?
Yeah, but I have a different experience from playing different types of music. So
tell me how.
I find within the Comet Is Coming, like, my full body gets immersed in the music. I mean, for one, it's louder. It's just more vibrations on the actual stage. In the Comet Is Coming, I kind of go into, I guess, full trance mode, and by trance mode, I mean me as a conscious human being not being aware of what I'm doing.
A flow state.
Yeah, just watching myself act and going, hey, that's pretty nice. That happens more in the Comet Is Coming. I find in Sons of Kemet, I guess because it's my group in that I write all the tunes, there's something that kind of stays aware of the whole band dynamic. And I guess in Sons of Kemet, I'm personally thinking about what I'm going to compose for the band. So I'm always kind of keeping the ear out for what sounds good while on the stage and what we could do differently. And comments coming because I will never be telling Dan what to play and he'll never tell me what to play. You can just let go and just play and everyone does their thing.
So your own trance state, do you become unaware of the audience?
Yeah. Generally, I'm not that aware of the audience. I've started to actually play with that in the last few months and force myself to, especially in the Comet Is Coming, where I move around, the mic is in the bell of the saxophone, so I've got some motion, I can walk around. I've been forcing myself to like walk up to the front of the audience, like open my eyes and look at them. And I find the whole situation deeply awkward, being on stage anyway. So it's like a little in-joke to myself. Like, what happens when not having any reverence for the audience, enjoying when they're really feeling it, but just walking up with dead eyes and just looking there. And to me, it's like I see the audience, but it's nothing. It's just kind of just mass. It's just a mass of stuff. And I can look in there and I get a kick out of doing it.
How do you navigate that sort of feeling of awkwardness? You know, you get in front of people and they're just like, okay, we're waiting for something.
Yeah.
And you need to deliver it.
Oh, yeah. I'm just numb to anything but the music. Like when I walk on stage, I just pretend they're not there. Like I stubbornly pretend that no one actually is in the audience. And obviously I know that there are people in the audience, but it's like I glaze over and just do my thing. I take my shoes off and get ready to play. And I just kind of, in some ways, just do my job until the spirit hits me. So I don't get emotional. I don't think, oh my God, they're looking for something. They're expecting this, expecting that. I just go, I've got a job to do. I play the saxophone. I'm going to walk in front of them. I'm going to maybe walk up to the audience, stay there. It's very mechanical. It's not very emotionally engaged. But all the while, I'm just insanely listening to the music and trying to get to a situation where I can be unconcerned with the thoughts in my head. All the thoughts can just kind of stop. And then that's when the kind of trance-like state starts.
Shabaka Hutchings joins us. It's Last Quarter on WVTF. I'm Josh Jackson. You have a group, Shabaka, called Shabaka and the Ancestors.
Yeah.
And this is a result of your frequent trips to both Cape Town and Johannesburg, South Africa. That country has its own very distinctive history with improvised music. I mean, from Abdullah Ibrahim, obviously, to even modern-day folks, Mokoye Mbatha and Dile Yanana, all these folks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a really thriving organization of musicians who are playing something that is distinctively South African.
Mm.
How did you find yourself in that situation coming from another place? Some other places, actually.
Yeah. It was a long process. About 4 years ago, I started a relationship with a South African girl. And going, spending a month here, a month there, and every time I'd go, I'd try to meet musicians and just kind of hang out and, you know, play at some jam sessions. And over the course of 4 years, it's just gathering musical contacts, going out to see gigs, seeing what the scene is, till eventually it got to a point when I thought, I'm having all of these experiences and when I play with certain combinations of musicians, things really, really happen. Like, it's the feeling of, I don't know, when the stage completely lifts. Like, when you're playing and you feel like this is something special that's happening here. That was happening, you know, especially in the last 2 years, a lot when I went to Johannesburg and played with, say, Tumi or Mandela Duduzo. So I thought, I'm just going to document it with my music and see if I can, like, develop an album. And that was it within January of 2016, while I was supposed to be on holiday in Cape Town.
What kind of holiday is this?
Yeah, it's a rubbish one. But what I found is that I knew that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to make an album that's easy for the musicians to learn, but still sounds like a whole album. But I didn't want to have it be a pressurized thing, so I said 20 minutes a day. And I just wrote and organized for 20 minutes a day for the month. And by the end of that month, I had an album. So then we did one rehearsal, one gig, and then one, like, 6 or 7 hours in the studio.
What does the concept of ancestors and ancestry have to you as a practicing and performing musician?
If you think of ancestors, I guess you're thinking of the lineage. You're thinking of what did people do who might have been in your situation, or who, well, or whose situation has resulted in you being who you are. Like, what have they gone through? What were their views? How did they see the world? What was their temperament? And music is, I guess, one of the ways in which we can quantify that. You know, people can write anything. It can you can write down your thoughts. You can write down what you want other people to think that your thoughts are, and the kind of person you want them to remember you as. And you can find out about your ancestors in that way, or you can read what people project onto them, what people say about them. But with music, it's a direct source. And I guess when you're talking about ancestors and lineage, it's not necessarily down straight bloodlines. You could be talking about human lineage. What have humans before in my social class done within, you know, in their times to battle? You know, how have they interpreted what they were seeing socially within sonic form? Music is one of, I think, the true ways that people can actually express that. It's unfiltered. It's straight from there, from how they experience the world, to you. So I guess Wisdom of the Elders is a tribute to that way of thinking about information spreading from generation to generation.
What does it mean to live with music?
To live with music is for it not to be important for me, because it's your life. It's like the music isn't important in and of itself. Like, the music is you. Like, if you value yourself, you value the music. For me, the importance can be you seeing the music as a separate entity that you've got to hold and keep and protect. Like, you've got to protect yourself. You've got to protect the way that your mind works. You've got to protect the openness of your mind and the living quality of your mind and your whole being. And if you do that, then the music will be healthy. And that's, for me, what we want. We want healthy music that's wholesome and for a good purpose.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.